This program was recorded with a live audience. Please forgive the occasional sound fluctuations.
This program has a unique title. It's called It's Never Crowded Along the Extra Mile. And that is something that came to me many years ago from an observation in a poem called The Road Less Traveled. And I thought about that road less traveled a lot. And I've often said to my children, and I've observed it in my own life, that that whole idea of being willing to go the extra mile, that when you do that, you're always or almost always on what we call the road that is less traveled. It's not crowded out there. And I'm not talking here about principles or ideas or secrets for success and inner peace that have to do with getting ahead, with making more money than the next guy, with being better than anybody else, with accumulating a lot of things. I'm speaking here about the extra mile in which you are living a deeper and a richer experience of life. And that all of the other people that you run into in your life who are not there with you, or that you are observing living lives of turmoil and anxiety and worry and stress and so much of the stuff that occupies most people's lives is just not a part of your life any longer. I believe there's a place that you can reach, and I believe these 10 principles, they're not just something that I said, alright, I got to come up with 10 things, so here, let's start numbering. I've been giving commencement speeches for the past 30 years. I've attended many, many commencements. It seems like every year I go to a commencement. When you have 8 children, they're always graduating from something, right? Whether it's nursery school or grade school or graduate school. And I've listened to a lot of these talks, and I've given a lot of these talks, and they always, of course, talk about how the word commencement means to commence, and that you're going to start, and this is just an opening and a beginning. And then most of the time, there is a launching into the means for being successful that have a lot to do with what I call the ego. That is evaluating who you are on the basis of how much you get and how much you achieve and what your reputation is. And these are not what the principles that I speak about at all in the commencement addresses that I've given, nor will they be the focus of this program and what we're speaking about here. I was handed a book when I was a young man, when I graduated from high school, by my uncle, called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And I read it when I was in the Navy. I joined the Navy right after high school in 1958. And I was aboard ship out in the Pacific, and I just started reading this book. And it really wasn't about getting rich, I should say. It wasn't about making a lot of money. It was really about living a deeper and a richer experience of life. And he was making distinctions in there between people who are able to create a life in which they live everything that they want and are able to attract into their lives the things that are important to them, and the people who can't do those things. And in the process of reading it, I was immediately sorry that I had joined the Navy for 4 years. And I had 4 years ahead of me to contemplate trying to live in a system in which I was required to be just like everybody else, and a system in which I had to dress like everybody else, and a system in which having a mind of your own was, let's just say, it was not encouraged at that time. And it still isn't in those kinds of operations. And this isn't at all a put-down of the military in any way. It was, I began to realize at a very young age that there was something that was much deeper about creating a life of what I would like to have in my life. And I also realized that I had been doing a lot of it for most of my life up until that point. That growing up in a series of foster homes and orphanages as a young man, I had somehow been able to figure out naturally how to attract abundance into my life without being consumed with worry about scarcity and not having enough, if you will. I had been just fortunate enough to know that if I could put my mind and my thoughts and my attention on what it is that I wanted to create for myself, that I had the ability to make it happen. And I did it always, even as a very young boy. And one of the things that Napoleon Hill spoke about that really became a very important item for me in my life was this idea of having what he called this burning desire. And a burning desire is something that is very different than a normal desire that everybody has. Because if you study Buddhist texts, they talk about how it's important to get past desire in your life. And I tried to do that for a while, but I found as long as I'm incarnated into this physical body, desires just go with the program. It seems to me, anyway. I mean, even if you want to go to the bathroom, you know, you got to figure out how to get there. You know, desire just seems to be not something that is so bad. I never thought it was something. Deepak Chopra and I have talked many, many times. In fact, in some of the tapes we've put out together, we've talked about this idea that desire isn't anything that is bad. It's when it becomes something that we become attached to. And I'll talk about that a little bit later in the very first principle. But a burning desire is something very different. And I don't know, I'm not certain about this. I have 8 children. And I watched 5 of them be born. Before that, they didn't even allow men on the same floor, all right? but as I watched these children being born, and I was cutting the cord and holding these tiny little infants who just showed up in the world, and then I watched them grow, and now they're adults, young adults, and some of them are still teenagers. I have a sense that we come into this world with personalities and with a purpose. Khalil Gibran, the great Lebanese poet, once said that when you are born, your work is placed in your heart. And I have a very strong sense that there's much more to us showing up here in this world and what took place before that. I'm not talking about past lives, although I've read many lives, many masters, and I've talked with Brian Weiss and people like this about this, and certainly I haven't closed myself off to it. But I haven't any internal personal experiences of something called a past life. But I have 8 children, and I've seen those children come in, and the ones that came in and were angry when they showed up and were screaming and hollering and you couldn't get them to get quiet and they wouldn't sleep through the night and they stuck their tongue out at you when you looked at them. Now they're in their 20s and I come home and they still are angry and they still are not happy to see me. And the ones that were laughing and happy and slept through the night and were very peaceful, and 18, 20 years later, they seem to be very peaceful, and they said there just seem to be, like, we almost come in with personalities. And there's hardly a mother that has given birth to a child who doesn't understand what I'm talking about. I see mothers here in the room. You know, I know your mothers because you're going like this and that. And you saw those babies come in, and you saw them have something called a personality. And if they have that, I mean, I have one daughter who came into this world with language. from another place. And when you sleep in the same room with her, when you slept in the same room with her when she was 3 and 4 years old, she was doing something very oriental. Hung, he hung, do it. And she would go through all of these kinds of motions and all of that. And now when she's now 16, and I slept in a room with her not too long ago in a motel, and she was in the bed across the room, and all of a sudden in the middle of the night I thought I was in Vietnam or I was in Cambodia or something, and this person was doing these and I remember taking her to a place in Bali when she was 3 or 4 years old, and the very first time she ever saw rice, she ate it as if she was Oriental. She was doing this. When we saw the rice paddies driving through the in Bali, I've never had seen her get with that kind of excitement, almost as if she recognized something. It's almost as if she felt she had come home. And I could go into a long stories about this young woman, but I have a sense that there is more to it, that we do come into this world with something, and I believe that we come in with a heroic mission. We show up here with something, some reason for us, and inside of each and every one of us, there is a desire to be able to do something, to be able to create something, a desire to prove something in one's life, whatever it might be. And I've had it my entire life, and I've never been able to put it out. But the question that I have as I begin this program is whether or not you can infuse it in others. Whether you can give somebody who doesn't have a burning desire that burning desire and act. I think it takes a very high level of consciousness to be able to influence people in that way. I suggest that it's possible, but I do know for certain that any person at any time, at any moment in their life, when they are ready, when they truly are ready, that whatever teachers or whatever you need to be able to infuse yourself with that kind of burning desire, you can have it. It can happen in an instant. And that powerful change can take place in moments. In fact, that's the only place it ever does take change. I remember a woman telling me that my young daughter, at that time she was about 6, had been invited to come over to her house by her daughter. And she had been 75 to 100 pounds overweight for her entire life, her entire adult life. And my little girl looked at her girlfriend's mother, whom she had never seen before, and blurted out, "I didn't know your mommy was fat." I don't know where she gets that kind of, audacity. I don't know, just speak what's on her mind, but at any rate, she did. And the mother looked at her and heard out of the mouth of this little child these words. And she said, "I decided in that instant that I was never going to be fat again." She said she was my teacher. And I had a level of readiness to change it. And she said, "I hadn't been able to do it for my entire adult life, which was over 20 years. And she was trim and slim and has been for 10 or 12 years. And when she was ready, the teacher appeared in the form of one of my little wiseacre children making that kind of an observation. And a burning desire is something that we can be infused with. I remember receiving a letter from a woman in Seattle, Washington, who was a crack cocaine addict, prostitute, living on the streets, and was as far down as it's possible for a human being to get. She was waking up each morning in her own vomit and in her own urine, and she was living the life of someone who was not going to be alive very much longer. She had lost a lot of weight. Her skin was peeling off. Apparently crack cocaine has all kinds of horrible reactions on the skin and so on. And she was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And she walked into a drugstore and there was a spindle there with audio tapes on it, a series of them. And she spun it around, and she was going to steal something so that she could go out and get some more cocaine. And there was a tape on there that I had produced 25 years before, called How to Be a No-Limit Person. And she stole the tape and put it in her purse and went back to wherever, whatever hotel room that she was staying in, and she had, there was a cassette player in there, and she put the tape in, and she wrote me a letter after listening to that tape and made contact with me and told me that she wanted to clean up her life and so on, and I started talking to her, and we went on a national television show about a year later, and today, many, many years later, I still get a Christmas card from her every year, and I still talk to her periodically. She has two children, she's married, and she runs her own business. She's president of her own business. She transformed her life in an instant. So that when people say it's impossible to change, or that I can't do something, or something is impossible, I always think about that burning desire, that once it's placed in there, and once you have it. And I was approached by the people at public television to put together a couple of programs a few years back based upon two of my earlier books. One was called Manifest Your Destiny, and the other was called Wisdom of the Ages. And I was told by all of the people who are knowledgeable about public television that America wouldn't really be receptive to donating money and pledging support to public television for messages that have something to do with spirituality, higher consciousness, and self-development and so on, that this just wasn't, it wasn't something that you could raise money for public television of. So in the process of putting the shows together, we found that we didn't have very much support from the executives in charge of public television specials. And we couldn't get the funding and so on. So I put up some of my own money and got some other people that believed in me, including Hay House, Louise Hay, and people like that. And we got all of the money together. And we went out and produced two shows. One was called How to Get What You Really, 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 Really Want, and the other was called Improving Your Life Using the Wisdom of the Ages. Now, what I have learned about myself, and what I'm speaking about here in the opening of this program, is that this thing called a burning desire is something that once you get it, it's like, I guess, what, herpes? It never goes away. You can't get rid of it. It stays with you. And even if you try to just, if you feel like you're on a mission of some kind in your life, and something comes along that offers a little different way of doing it, you can't just do it in a sort of half-hearted way. You can't return back and go back to the place where everybody else is along the mile. It's the extra mile where there are no crowds, where you're all alone, where you start to live and you start to run your life. And for me, it has been about raising the consciousness of this country and this world. It's been about looking for outlets, whether it's media, whether it's publishing, whether it's radio, television, newspapers, magazines, whether it's giving talks. It's always about creating as a critical mass of people, that when we reach enough people who reach a certain level of consciousness, and I'll be talking about this a little bit more in the tapes that follow. And it's always an exciting prospect for me. There's many wonderful things that flow into my life as a result of producing tapes and appearing on television and writing books. It's offered me a wonderful, abundant life that I'm very grateful for. But inside, there's like this burning desire is like having a candle flame, an inner candle flame that never flickers. Though the worst goes before you, whatever the worst might be, whatever the obstacles, whatever the number of people who tell you something can't be done, these just become incentives to show the world that this burning desire that I have is going to be continued to be fueled from within. And I'm going to fulfill this purpose. Because I know that when I showed up here on this planet in 1940, that something was placed in my heart about what I have to do. I have absolutely no doubt about that. The same way I have no doubt about each one of my children, one of whom just wants to ride horses and give lessons to little children and has dropped out of college and said, "Dad, I just don't want to go to college." And I said, if being fulfilled and feeling happy and enjoying your life comes from taking little children and putting them on horses. And she said, "You don't understand. I'm a horse whisperer. I can talk to horses. I know how they feel." And this has been her life. I said, "Well, then go for that. Be that. Do that. Going to college is not necessary for you at all if that's where you want to go. And besides, colleges are always open. When I taught at a university for many, many years, I was oftentimes the youngest person in the room. Most of my students were older than I was when I taught at St. John's University in graduate school back in the 70s. So that it's really about fulfilling an inner kind of destiny, a destiny that once you feel it and once you feel it, you can't stop it. So with this kind of inner burning desire, I took on, just like when Your Erroneous Zones was published back in 1976, and I was told by all of the various publishing houses and told, given all the reasons why you can't go out to America. I remember an executive telling me in New York that you can't reach everybody in America unless you go on the Today Show, appear on the Tonight Show, or get on Phil Donahue, or get on the Dinah Shore Show, or whatever the network shows were at that time. And I was just sitting there thinking, but there is another way to go to everybody in America. And that's to go to everybody in America. Just get out there and get in your car and go do that. And doesn't that sound like an exciting prospect, the idea of doing it yourself and going from city? Coal miner's daughter for Erroneous Zones. I was Loretta Lynn, right? Just going from station to station and delivering my books and just having the time of my life until ultimately many wonderful things began to happen. But it was like that inner burning desire is something that when there's people out there telling you that something can't be done, and this is the way it was with the public television thing. And so what I did is once we created the shows and we finally had them taped and so on, and had invested the money ourselves in them, I went to every public television station in America that would have me. And I made 68 visits. Now that's 68 cities to go to. And that's an awful lot of hotel rooms, and it's a lot of connections in Atlanta and Cincinnati and Salt Lake City and Dallas and so on. But it was that thing that's in here. It's that burning desire to be able to not just have success come my way, because never did I ever think how much money I would make or how much I would even be able to raise. Always it was about, here's a way to reach an awful lot of people. And I look at television, and I heard a statistic that said that the average child in America has seen 12,000 murders in his own living room and family room and bedroom on cable and commercial television before his 14th birthday. I read that or saw that someplace, and I thought, sure, they're simulations. Sure, there are people who are paid to act as if that is, but they don't all know the distinction. And you remember the events of the 11th of September in 2001, and so many children, 6, 7, and 8 years old, who've been accustomed to playing on video games in which people are killed all the time, just assumed that in the next minute they would all get up. And the building, while it all went down, in the next, it'll go back up again, and we'll start all over again. There was almost like they had become inured to the continuous reinforcement of violence as entertainment, and it had become a new way of life. And I've said to many, many parents, now I know that generation upon generation of people have been saying, for as far back as Cicero, you know, when we were kids, the way the world was, and then it happened in the first century and the second century, and I guess I'm saying that here, but I know for certain that when I was a young boy, that the way children talked to their parents, including myself, is very different than the way children talk to their parents today. How many of you have noticed that in the room here? Most hands go up. That we have a medium out there of talking back and being sort of smart alecky and seeing how wise you can be, a wiseacre you can be, and seeing how obscene you can be, or seeing how cute you can be, or just whatever. But that there's almost like there's been this lack of respect, not for the, necessarily for someone because that they're older, but just the lack of respect. I remember thinking when my mother got our family back together again, that nobody in my family, my two brothers or myself, and my mother was a little woman and never said to any of us, you have to respect me, and you can't swear in front of me, and you don't talk back to me, and you will do your chores. She never said that. She never threatened us once. There was an unstated awareness that you spoke with respect to this person. And every friend that I had in the neighborhood where I grew up on, it was the east side of Detroit. It wasn't any fancy neighborhood or anything like that. It was a very middle class, lower middle class neighborhood where everybody had paper routes and worked in, as bag boys and so on. But I never went into anybody's home and ever heard children talking to their parents and talking to others the way I hear it today. Nor do I tune into television, sir. I mean, I watched a show on a network television show just the other night, and I was in shock at how many times profanity was used on a regular network television show. The first time I'd seen that, because I very seldom have that kind of thing, that kind of energy. And it's all about energy. It's all about what kind of energy we allow into our lives and what kind of energy we allow into our homes. And the thing I loved about public television is that you don't see murders. And you don't see children in situation comedies in the name of entertainment seeing who they could put down in order to create a laugh. And then the laugh track is put in so that in case you don't think it's funny, we've just decided that it is for you. You don't see that. And it's a way of raising consciousness. And it was always about this idea of creating a higher energy, so that my idea about secrets or principles for inner peace and success have more to do with raising energy than anything else. So after those 68 cities and being told that we couldn't raise money and so on, I can report here very proudly that we passed the 20 million dollar mark in money raised with those two, with those first two shows. $20 million for public television. So then I was asked if we could possibly put together two more shows. And this time they sent a limo. It was very different. And this time we had much more of an opportunity to have the kind of input and to create and produce the kind of programs that I really felt would fulfill this inner burning desire, this way of reaching as many people in the world as we can with a different and a unique message. And so I settled on recording in a place that is in American history as significant to the freedoms that we enjoy as any city in America. And it was in Concord, Massachusetts. And we traveled to Concord, and of course we're told that we can't do it in Concord. And you can't, because you have to bring in, when you do something like a television special, it requires all kinds of people. And big trucks and shadow preventers and people to stop the birds from singing and all, you know, all of the different things. And it was huge, and there's budget after budget and so on. But we went to Concord, Massachusetts on the 29th of August in the year 2001. And we opened the show crossing a bridge. And I want to tell you a little bit about this bridge and lead into this program with this story. I'd like to take you back to a very powerful day in American history. It was the 19th of April, and it was 1775. And on the 19th of April in 1775, on one side of this river that flows through Concord, there were a group of farmers, and they stood on this bank. And now you have to remember that a couple of hundred years had passed since these people. A couple hundred years is a very long time. It's many, many generations of people who had now been here since the 1500s and early 1600s. And they had been told how to think and had to have their taxes paid to a person who lived on the other side of this huge ocean in this little island. And the religion that the people were told to practice was imposed upon them by the state and by the king. And there was no freedom in making those kinds of choices about how I would like to think and how I would like to live my life. And very often the people were taxed and they'd had no representation at all in paying their taxes. And it was getting worse and worse by that time. And on the other side of this river, there were a group of soldiers from that little island. And that group of soldiers were there to quell the people from reacting too violently. They were there to put down any resistance, because there was an awful lot of resistance. You know, Victor Hugo in Les Miserables once said that there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And he suggested that when the time has come to change something, whether it's in your life and whether it's in your relationships, whether it's in your business, when the time has come, it's an idea. It isn't that it's a timing thing. It's an idea. It's an inner kind of invisible thing called an idea. And when it shows up in your life, there's nothing more powerful than that. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's like that inner candle flame. It becomes a burning desire. And you have to act upon it, or you will slowly die. You'll stop functioning the way you want to function in your life. And a shot was fired that day on the 19th of April, 1775. And a soldier on the other side of the river fell dead. And there was a man who was one of those farmers who was there with those people. His name was William Emerson. And he was the pastor at the first parish in Concord at that time. And that was the beginning of the American Revolution and the French Revolution. But more than that, it was the beginning of the way we began to treat people. Because we then, after this war, we created something called a constitution, which was giving the rights of man and women, such as us here today, listening freely to me talk about these things. I couldn't have given this talk in 1775 without having it approved first by the authorities. And we don't have to do that anymore. And in that Constitution, it made it really clear that the rights of man originated from in spiritual principles, from the divine rights of their Creator. That these the idea that people are created equal, and the idea that we all have equal rights, was not anything that existed on this side of the pond. It didn't exist on the other side of the big pond either, the Atlantic Ocean either. This was a new and radical idea, even though we've taken it for granted. All right. And then in the same Constitution, just a few lines later, they made it really clear that every man shall be free from the establishment of a religion. So that there was something that was laid out that said, we have our rights come to us from spiritual principles, yet we are free from having a religion imposed upon us. Because spirituality unites, whereas religion divides. And divides in the sense of excludes some and excludes others and so on. And this was not to be, so that there's no place in the Constitution which says that there shall be separation of God and state. Someone left me a letter on an envelope one day at a talk that said, Dear God, question to God, why did you allow all of those children in that school in Colorado to be killed? And the answer from God said, didn't you know I'm not allowed in schools anymore? And I thought it was just an interesting kind of the idea that somehow we can't have spirituality, we can't have God, we can't have higher consciousness principles in our schools and teach them and practice them and make them a part of our life, because we associate that with religion, has been one of the real miscalculations, I think, and misinterpretations of in our society. And I'll talk more about that a bit later as well. But 61 years later, it's now the 19th of April, and it's 1836. And at that same spot, at the Old North Bridge, where I opened this show called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem, based upon a book that I wrote of that title, I walked across that bridge and read the monument that was erected that day that William Emerson's grandson, whose name was Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was really the founder, one of the founders of the school of American philosophy that didn't exist before them. And in Concord, Massachusetts, in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, here's who lived there. Bronson Alcott lived in a home that I walked through that day before we started the show. He had a daughter named Louisa May, who was one of the most famous writers of her time. Next door, right next door, there's a house, and that's where Nathaniel Hawthorne lived. And just a couple of streets over and a few houses down was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And two streets over from that was Henry David Thoreau. And Julia Ward Howe lived in that town. And they all came to this school of philosophy. And they were talking about ideas. Now, in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, they were talking about ideas that that we take for granted today. You know, Emerson went to Ralph Waldo Emerson, gave a lecture at the Harvard School of Divinity, and he wasn't invited back for 33 years, and he was the most famous man in America in his lifetime. He was more famous than Lincoln in his lifetime. He was called America's teacher. He and Mark Twain, all over the country, would just go out and give talks and writing incredible poetry and so on. They all lived in this one little energy spot called Concord, Massachusetts. And Thoreau, who went to prison because he refused to pay his taxes to a government that was doing to the Native Americans what they were doing. It was our Holocaust. And, you know, I had dinner the other night with my mother, who is almost 86 years old. And when my mother was born, now that's one generation ago. When my mother was born, women couldn't vote in America. Women, half the people in our country couldn't vote when my mom was born, and my mom's still around. They were talking back in the 1830s about the absurdity of women not being able to vote and women's suffrage. This was almost 100 years before it came about. They were opening up something called the Underground Railroad in Concord, Massachusetts, so that they would have a place for people who were leaving slavery. And this was 30 and 40 years before the Emancipation Proclamation, before the Civil War, when you risk your life to do this. This was what was going on. These were not just philosophers. These were people who put it into their lives and lived it and practiced it and being there. And here's what Emerson, Ralph Waldo, the grandson of his grandfather who was at that Old North Bridge. This is what he wrote as they sang this hymn on that particular day, on the 19th of April, 61 years later. And you can go to Concord and walk across that bridge and get a sense, and when you walk through the town, you sense the energy. I wanted to record there. And record there we did. He said, "By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flags to April's breeze unfurled. Here once embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world." And I want to read the rest of it to you as well. There's three other verses. He said, "The foe long since in silence slept. Alike the conqueror silent sleeps, and time the ruined bridge has swept down the dark stream which seaward creeps. On this green bank, by this soft stream, we set today a votive stone that memory may their deed redeem when, like our sires, our sons are gone. Spirit that made these heroes dare to die and leave their children free, bid time and nature gently spare the shaft we raise to them and thee." I just don't think writing gets much better than that, to tell you the truth. Spirit that made these heroes dare to die and leave their children free. And who do you think their children are? That's us, every single one of us. We owe an incredible debt of gratitude to people who took it upon themselves to create a state of consciousness and to state it in this American school of what is called transcendentalism, and to bring a sense of spirit. And that when I talk about the road less traveled, when I talk about the extra mile and it's never crowded, boy, I'll tell you, I long that extra mile. When I write, I have a picture of Emerson and a picture of Thoreau. And I think about what it must have been like to be them and to go to prison and to go to Walden and to leave all of that behind and to take the criticism that was out there and to create a sense of... Well, they were the people who were responsible for the fact that not only that women can vote today, but that it isn't just white males that can vote today. That anybody, and that all of us are free. That's a spiritual principle. That's not a religious principle. And we took those two shows and we taped them. One of them is called "There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem." And the other one is called "My Top 10 10 Secrets for Success and Inner Peace." Now, this program deals with them in much more depth. I dealt with all of them in a very short time there. Then I took those shows after we recorded them in the First Parish, right there in Concord, and we took them out and were told by, again, so many of the authorities who were certain that they knew what could work and what wouldn't work. We took it out, and in just 16 days... in the very first pledge period, we raised between $7 and $10 million. And it's just beginning. because there's a hunger out there. And all the time, I was out there thinking about we're raising money for public television. What we're really doing is creating a new energy. But for me, it's always been about this is just another wonderful opportunity to fulfill something called a burning desire. A burning desire that is rooted in these principles. I'd like to also just share with you something that I wrote a few years ago. It was in a book called You'll See It When You Believe It. And I took it from a woman who I admired enormously. Her name is Peace Pilgrim. And this was a woman who just believed so strongly in the idea of peace. And since this program is about 10 principles for success and inner peace, I'd kind of like to define inner peace and success and then move on to that very first principle and go through those 10 principles in this program. She left everything that she had, gave up her name, threw away her birth certificate, her social security card. No one knew her identity. And she proceeded to walk across America. And she walked for years and years and years. And wherever she went, she was like St. Francis in the 13th century, or like Jesus 13 centuries before that. Just this beautiful soul walking amongst people and just promoting peace and harmony. And she was, I communicated with her, and I felt very blessed to have done so. It's one of the great honors of my life. The other was to appear in Vienna, Austria, with a man whose name is Viktor Frankl in 1978, who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning and lived in the concentration camps and decided that he was going to survive the horrors of places like Auschwitz because he had to tell the story and he had a sense of purpose and he had to tell it and he kept notes. And there I was, a young psychologist with a bestseller, sitting on the stage with this man who had been through it, and I was just in... Well, Rumi put it this way. He said, sell your cleverness and purchase bewilderment. And I was in a state of bewilderment and awe. And when they asked me questions, I just went, blah, 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 blah. I have nothing to say around this person. I felt that way about Peace Pilgrim as well. And she died out there on the road. She was hit by a car years ago. And she had what she called the symptoms of inner peace. Symptoms of inner peace. I love these. So that if you're starting to develop a sense of inner peace in your own life, here are some of the symptoms. Most of the time when we hear symptoms, we think about the symptoms of a disease, don't we? Or the symptoms of a relationship falling apart. Or the symptoms of a malaise. Or the symptoms of scarcity in our lives. But there's another set of symptoms. And this is what they are. She said the first, there's 10 of these. She said the first symptoms that you are gaining inner peace is that you'll have a tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than on fears based on past experiences. Spontaneity. Less having to plan things out and figure it out. More being willing to just do things that seem to make sense to you. And when I think about spontaneity and spontaneous healing, and I'll talk about this in some of the later principles, that whenever spontaneous healing ever takes place, whether it's the healing of a relationship or it's the healing of a disease, and sometimes when it's the healing of something as severe and serious as cancer, or high blood pressure, or diabetes, or any kind of disease process that people think is absolutely incurable, and people experience some kind of a spontaneous change, that it comes about as a result of living more peacefully and radiating out more peace outward. So that's the first symptom. The second, she said, is an unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment. That inner peace, the symptom of inner peace, is that you start going through your life. And here we are in a place called Miraval, out in between Tucson and Phoenix in Arizona. And it's just filled with so many wonderful opportunities for spiritual growth and joy. And I was walking out there this morning, and we just happened to stop at a cactus. Now, you know, you think about a cactus, and you think, well, it's a cactus, and it's a little prickly, and so on. But the ability to just stop and stare for a moment, and to listen, and to watch a jackrabbit walk past it, and to see the sky, the way that it it seems so big out here. The opportunity to take any moment in your life and to begin to enjoy it is one of the symptoms of inner peace. You'll start knowing you have more of it. A third principle, she said, or symptom of inner peace is a loss of interest in judging other people. It just no longer becomes important. You begin to understand the truth behind the idea that when you judge another person, you don't really define them. You define yourself as someone who needs to judge. And it just starts to become less and less important. And you find yourself no longer putting labels on others and finding fault and looking for the... I remember in my training that I was taught by a great teacher in my life to always address people that you don't know if you don't know their name. Even if it's a young person asking for an autograph or whatever, always address them with a title of respect. Just get in the practice of that. And we were required to do that for almost a year. So if someone said hello to you, you'd say, yes, ma'am. No, sir. Even if it was a 12-year-old boy, yes, sir. And the reason we were doing that is not because we were addressing the form, but we were addressing the unfolding of God. And that's what we were told to notice first. And when you see the unfolding of God in anyone, what you first see is that which deserves respect. And you address that. And judgment becomes almost impossible. A fourth symptom is a loss of interest in interpreting the actions of others. Peace is something that you start to experience in your life when it's no longer necessary for you to explain away why other people are doing what they're doing. Interpretation becomes less significant than just allowing. I have a pillow that was made for me by a dear friend many, many years ago that sits on my couch in my office. And it has two words on it. And I look at it every day. It says, I'm allowed. And I like it. I'm allowed. The next is this number five, right? A loss of interest in conflict. That conflict is something that you just seem to not want to be a part of any longer. You just find yourself moving away from it. And if you're in a relationship or in relationships with people who thrive on conflict and want more and more of it, you find yourself just passing. You know, just, and it's an internal kind of, I pass here. That's no longer where I want to go. And I have found it's very quite simple when you're in a state of inner peace to pass. And the way that you do it is you don't let the other person know that you're passing. You see, it's like trying to pick a fight with someone who's not interested in fighting. After a while, they just give up and go on and try to find somebody else who's wanting that back. And conflict is just something you just start to pass on in your life. And it's really quite easy to do. And then before you know it, you stop watching the news as much, because the news is almost always designed to create conflict. And you stop reading tabloids, because the tabloids are attempting to create conflict in you. And conflict is something that you just say, no longer for me. I pass. The next, is, she said, is a the symptom of inner peace, is a loss of the ability to worry. You just stop it. People say, but how can you stop worrying? And I remember a great teacher saying to me, it makes no sense, this was in India, it makes no sense, he said, to worry about the things you have no control over. Because if you have no control over them, it makes no sense to worry about them. And I thought about that, and I wrote it down. I said, that's good. And then he said, it makes no sense to worry about the things that you do have control over. Because if you've got control over them, it makes no sense to worry about them. And I wrote that down. And I said, that's even better. And then he concluded by saying, there goes everything it's possible to worry about. And you no longer seem to have an interest in going there. The next is you begin to experience frequent and overwhelming episodes of appreciation, contented feelings of connectedness with others and nature. Frequent and overwhelming episodes of appreciation and contented feelings of connectedness with others and nature. There are two levels of energy in our life. One is depreciation and one is appreciation. Depreciation will always weaken you. Appreciation will always strengthen you. If you're a person who depreciates, that is, finds fault with, rather than beginning to accept and enjoy and find what is good. I've often said probably that when people say, what's the best rule you know about child raising? I said, try to catch your children doing things right as much as you possibly can. And they say, well, you don't know my kids. When I was a teacher, I used to say to them about how great they were at doing things right. And I'd try to find things doing things right. And if they got their name right, I'd say, now we got a good start here. And I'd always talk to them about appreciating them. I remember telling them that they were all winners. I remember teaching in the inner city of Detroit in a junior high school and saying to all the kids, every one of you are winners. And they'd say, how could you say that, Dr. Dyer? That's not possible. I'd say, well, in every orgasm, there's 250 billion spermatozoos. And I'd draw a whole bunch of dots on the board. Dot, 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 dot. 250 billion. And they're all in a race for one egg. And guess what? You won the first race you were ever in. And say, wow! I say, you put 250 billion anythings down there, you know, what are the odds that you're going to win? What an incredible person you must be, you know. Appreciation. Finding as much possibility. And the other, of course, is contented feelings of connectedness with others and with nature. When you're here at Miraval, wherever you are in your life, whomever you meet here, whomever you're with, begin to see that mystical consciousness, that higher consciousness, is really about being connected to rather than separate from. As John Donne, the 15th century poet, said, no man is an island, entire of himself. Every man's death diminishes me. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. As you begin to see yourself less as separate from each other, and even separate from what you would like to attract into your life, and more as connected to each other, and already connected to what you are intending to create in your life, you'll start to realign your inner intention and create and manifest things into your life that you never thought were possible before. It's separation versus connectedness. The ninth is, you'll find yourself having frequent attacks of smiling, she said. And you can tell people, you know, one of the levels, one of the ways to evaluate spiritual consciousness and higher awareness is how much does a person smile and how cheerful are they? Cheerfulness is one of the qualities of spirituality. If you find yourself down, unhappy, depressed, morose, fearful, anxious, you're experiencing those emotions, and at the moment you're experiencing them, if you can stop and work at a smile, and just look in the mirror at yourself and notice how glum you look. Notice the physical appearance that you have. But that's lower energy. That is weakening. Not only is it weakening the muscles of your face and making you frown and so on, but it weakens your heart. It weakens your lungs. It weakens your blood. It weakens the entire system. And if you can shift that to having more frequent attacks of smiling. And finally, she said, an increased susceptibility to the love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it. An increased susceptibility to the love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it. I remember William Butler Yeats once writing about when he would find himself feeling most peaceful in his life is when he had the almost uncontrollable urge to extend love at any moment in his life. And I think it's appropriate as we look at the idea of it never being crowded along the extra mile. That the principles of inner peace and success that are going to follow here are based upon those symptoms, and they're based upon something so simple and yet so elusive to most people. An internal burning desire, an inner candle flame that never flickers regardless of what goes before you. And then you begin to practice these principles. And each of these principles that follow are principles that I have practiced and lived and will attempt to convey in stories to make it come home for you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Comments, thoughts, what we'd like to do? Yes, ma'am. What is your first name? It's Dana.
One of the challenges that I have in my own personal development is that I love what you say. I want it. When I get challenged, I find it difficult for my heart. How do you get your heart and your brain to be congruent?
Thanks. That's a great question. You get your heart and your brain to be congruent the same way you learn to hit a backhand in tennis. The same way you learn how to play a game of chess. The same way you learn how to set your VCR. The same way you learn how to meditate. You do it not just with practice, but you do it with a commitment to it. And when you have a commitment to it, you are raising your energy level. And I'll speak a lot here in this program about energy and energy levels. And very often the reason our heart is not congruent with our thoughts is because we allow ourselves to become immersed in lowered energy fields. And we allow, people say to me so often, what you say sounds great, but you don't know what it's like to be in my family. You don't know what it's like to be around my children. You don't know what it's like where I work. I'm in a world which is, you know, noisy, which is rude, which is filled with hatred and so on. What do I do about that? And I always say, who were the most influential people that ever walked on this planet? And what did they have to teach us? That's what you want to go to. What did Jesus say to us? What did Moses say to us? What did Buddha say? What did Muhammad? These weren't just great teachers. These were people who lived at a higher energy field, who sent love in response to hate, who sent joy in response to sadness, who had forgiveness in their hearts as the only thing that they had to give away. You practice that. You practice it, and you stop yourself when you find yourself moving. It's like with the backhand. When you go to hit your backhand, and all of a sudden you hit one and it goes over the fence, you don't keep doing that. You don't just keep saying, well, I just can't help it. It just keeps going over the... You stop, and you make the correction instantaneously, at the moment. And if you start to practice it before long, it doesn't take very long. It's like I told you about the woman who was the prostitute up in Seattle. I mean, she made a decision that she was no longer going to be a victim in her life, and she was no longer going to be, and she was addicted to one of the strongest substances that you, and she changed overnight, and she's never gone back. She made, you know, she made a heart connection. And I always say, you know, I repeat the prayer of St. Francis every day, two or three times a day. And when I repeat that prayer, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. Those are seven chapters in Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. And he said, O Lord, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console. To be loved as to love. To be understood as to understand. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying to self that we are born to eternal life. I just repeat that. And there's such energy in that. Eknath Eswaran taught me about the energy in that prayer. He said, carry it around with you. Carry that around with you. Just keep it in your pocket. It's right here in my pocket. I always have it with me. And the energy is always there. And it's just a very subtle kind of reminder. And the other thing I would say about keeping congruence is to turn it over to something that you're connected to, but that is higher than the energy of your thoughts. Turn it over to God, in other words. Just turn it over and watch and see what happens.
There are 10 principles that I'll be talking about in this program. 10 principles that really are the cornerstone of what my life has been about and what I have learned works and doesn't work in terms of attaining success and inner peace. Each one of these principles represents a way of thinking and living and practicing them that takes you away from the flock. I know when my little boy turned 13, in the Jewish tradition, of course, this is the stepping stone into adulthood with the bar mitzvah and so on. And I told him, while he's not Jewish, that this was really the opening time in his life for entering into, and many traditions and many cultures consider, adulthood. And I wrote him a little letter and asked him to save it. And one of the things I remember saying on the letter is that if you follow the herd, you'll end up stepping in shit, you know. It's just going to be a part of your life. There's going to be a lot of it, and if you're not stepping in it, you'll be trying to dodge it, and it'll be on your shoes, and so on. So you can either go along with the herd, go along with the flock, the crowd, if you will, and you'll find yourself having a lot of the kinds of problems that you don't have to have if you're out there in front. Or if you get out on that path and live in a way that you decide.